morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, part two. And I mistakenly said episode 225 on our last one. That was actually 226, so this one is 227. But we are back and better than ever with Alex Sarama from London, England, talking about Transforming Basketball Part 2. We've got a bunch of really, really good things I'm really excited to continue with Alex here today. But before we get going with that, I want to again thank our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha, Nebraska. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balance, neck, or spinal issues, have them go see Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi, 402-964-0300. Just be sure to let them know that a pen and a napkin sent you. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you are listening, download, rate, review. If it's iTunes, if it's Spotify, if it's whatever it may be, 5 stars, write a review. Just say good things about it, because when you do that, we'll move up in the rankings and people will want to when they say, I want to learn more about basketball, coaching basketball, there's A Pen and a Napkin right there. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Go to apenandanapkin.com. It's a coaching website. There's a lot of really, really good stuff there. Alex, are we ready for part two?
I sure am. Great to be back.
Yeah. Question for you before we get going here today. One of my favorite new shows of the last few years, Ted Lasso. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I loved it. It was great.
Well, yeah, I was just gonna say, what we know how much we loved it here in America. What did folks think of it in the UK?
I'd say it was just as popular.
Really,
it's funny because you know I'd say it's actually similar. I see the similarities to me being an English guy coaching basketball in the US. And him obviously being an American coaching soccer in the UK, so it was funny. I always found that funny when I watched the series, but I thought it was great because it showed what transformational coaching is all about.
Yeah, a lot of great stuff there. My wife and I got to the last 4 or 5 episodes, and we just binged it all in one night. We spent like 5 hours in front of the TV. And you get to the end, and my wife was bawling her eyes out. She's like, ah! So, just great stuff there. So just curious to know about that. So, hey, if you haven't listened to part one, that dropped yesterday. A lot of great stuff. We talked about constraints-led approach, kind of old school stuff, out with the old, in with the new, thinking of things differently. Now we're going to really get into how this part of it, in theory, our plan, right, Alex? Our plan is to talk about how to implement it into your 5-man team, 5-woman team. You know, how can you put it into your philosophy, your X's and O's philosophy, so that your team will be successful? Drills, different things like that. So let's just jump into it here, Alex. We talked a little bit in part one about pattern offenses versus conceptual offenses, motions offense, yeah, read and react, that type of thing. Early on in my career, I definitely was a pattern guy and a lot of sets. Like you said in part one, there's a place and time for set plays, and you got to run some sets every once in a while. And sometimes you just need to run the play to get Alex the shot at this spot right here. But overall, I really believe, and as I grew as a coach, that conceptual motion-based stuff and teaching kids how to make plays, read the defense, and then do what the defense gives them, so forth and that type of thing. But then you have the other side of it, where you have coaches that we just can't do this. We've been doing it for 2 weeks, and they're just not getting it, and we're struggling, and we got our butt kicked by 40 the other night, and they're as you can see me here, I'm throwing my hands up in the air, and all these other different things. So it's so easy to revert back to the old instead of trying to embrace the new. Let's start there.
Right. So I know the feeling, and I've been there too, and I think often as coaches at every level, there's a tendency when results start not going your way to just scrap the new stuff you're doing and pull back on the past. It's easily done. I think for me, a key thing I speak about, regardless of whether you're a sets coach, a motion, like a very scripted motion offense, or more of like, I guess, a conceptual offense, I think less is more. And I prefer to have far less going on in an offense, but doing it really, really well, than having a bunch of different things that I'm throwing at the players and just none of it sticks. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, there are some principles of play that apply regardless of your philosophy as a coach. I think there are some non-negotiable things you need. And that to me would be shot selection number one, having an actual clear identity as to what shots you're going for. And in the book, I talk about gold medals, silver medals, bronze medals. So you got your gold medal shots, any kind of like free throws, getting fouled in the act of shooting, rim, you know, rim inside the charge circle, etc. You got your catch and shoots. Catch and shoot three is your silver medal, and your off dribble three is your bronze. Now, I don't mind taking paint mid ranges for some players if they're efficient at it, but I don't think it's a shot that every player can take, even in high school, because I think maybe it's one, two, or three players who can be efficient, not everyone. And then you've got things like your spacing. So I call it floor is lava, not catching the ball in the mid-range. Now, you know, you might be running a trigger in the high post and or the low post. Of course, that's an exception. But for the most time, spacing in good locations where you're escaping the lava outside the three-point line or using the weak side dunker, so that when the play breaks down, you're actually in a good spacing. And something I see a lot with kind of heavy motion teams is that no advantage is created, and they don't kind of know what to go to, and they're in a pretty poor spacing location. So having these principles makes anything you do better. Now, I think the key difference kind of between behind the ideas, I guess, I wrote about in the book and what we see, I'd say, commonly in youth basketball in the States would be, I'm a big believer in running these triggers out of known spacing templates that the players know. But it could just be like one pick and roll, one get, and you don't script the entire pattern as to what happens after that. So it's literally just one trigger and boom. Mm-hmm. They should be starting dominoes, aka advantage basketball, off that through a coverage solution, I call it. Now, if they can't do that, then of course we need to re-trigger and get to another trigger, and that could be another pick and roll out of a good spacing. It could be a get action, a screen away. But again, it's like these one-off triggers as opposed to just running patterns, patterns, patterns.
Yeah. Sorry about the dinging in the background. The family got the family group chat going there a little bit. So.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the – let's go back to that a little bit more, and then let's jump into the dominoes, okay? So I think one of the things that you have to be willing to do if you're going to be a motion based coach, a conceptual coach, and the stuff that I sent to you, you've got to be willing and actually encourage mistakes while you're going through your small sided games in order to grow. In order to grow that basketball IQ, there's got to be an element of trial and error. And okay, I tried this. It just doesn't work. I thought it would work. I can't do that anymore. But if I do it like this, I can do it like this. And I think, again, kind of what we talked about, some of it what we talked about in part one, Alex, was with the willingness of coaches to let go, to allow their players to just do those things. And I think that through your constraints and the CLA and the small-sided games and that type of thing, one of the things I really liked about was scripting your practices in short bursts. Okay, for these 4 minutes, we're going to go 3-on-3, but here's the constraints. And now we're going to jump to, we're going to go 4 more minutes of 3-on-3, but now here's a new constraint to add on to the two that we had before. And that will help grow those players, and that's a big part of transforming the game as well. Can you dive into that a little bit more?
Yeah, that's 100% how I envision the CLA being used, as you just described. And I think the best part about it is the pace of a practice is so engaging for the players and actually the coaches. The some of the most frequented feedback I get from coaches is, I actually had a really nice message last week. It was from a high school coach, and he said, you know, I got into basketball again to try this after being out for a few years, and it's the most fun I've ever had coaching. And he said, you know, I really enjoy just the challenge of creatively planning constraints and practice planning. And the practice themselves, they go so fast because, you know, instead of just doing one drill for like 10 minutes or whatever, like you said, every 3, 4, 5 minutes, there's a new constraint. And I think that pace is so important because that's what exposes players to all the different scenarios that they need to problem solve to be good at the game. And I think, like you said, on the making mistakes part, it's very important because we would rather, as coaches, that most mistakes come out in practice than the game. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why this whole notion of perfect practice, it actually isn't that beneficial, because I don't think any coach would rather see live turnovers in a game compared to practice. So we need those mistakes because that's the players learning from it. And then, you know, we're not correcting every single mistake. We're seeing if there's a theme to the mistakes. Yes. So if we see the themes that constantly emerge, 100%, we're instructing. We're going in there like we've always done as coaches. But I'd say we're being a lot more specific and measured with the feedback, as opposed to just kind of this scattergun of giving a commentary or analysis about everything that we see.
How important is it for a coach to develop their vocabulary when it comes to their feedback? Yes. You know, Kevin Eastman, you know, coaching bullet points, Rick Pitino, 7-second corrections. You know, I so agree with you, Alex. You cannot correct every single mistake, because all you're going to be doing is correcting mistakes. And when you're talking, what are they not doing? They're not playing. They're not getting the repetitions necessary. I mean, I'm barking up your tree, big dog.
Yep. No, Marty, you nailed it. And that's the thing, like, really funny, because on part one, we spoke about how you can repurpose a lot of the good stuff from legendary coaches. You just mentioned Pitino and Eastman. And that is basically how to deliver feedback within the CLA. And I think the biggest problem I've seen, especially at the NBA level, is practice is like a coaching clinic. And it should not be a coaching clinic, right? Because, like you said, we can't confuse knowing for doing. So, yeah, you can speak to the players for minutes at a time and give them all this great information, a shell drill or whatever. But it doesn't mean that on the next rep or in the next game that the players are going to be able to do what you just told them. And I think as coaches, we always said, oh, but I told you in practice. But that's actually our fault when that happens, because it's not about telling them. It's about using the CLA to create the environment where they do what you told. And they live it, and they make mistakes. Sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't. But over time, they're going to do it more of the time than not, right? And that's why it's the feedback part is critical. And the language, you can't do that if you don't have the language. And answering the original question now, it's, you know, I think as people go through the book, they see a lot of like catchy phrases, things like dominoes, the medals. Mm-hmm. And the reason we have this is so that you can coach on the fly, like 6 seconds, 7 seconds or less, as you said, in bullet points, as Eastman talks about. And the only way you do that is having a glossary. And I think one of the best activities I recommend for coaches is create a program glossary. And you're going to have all the unique words, all the terminology that you use. Use it at every team, your middle school, JV, your feeder club. And that's how you can get all your coaches on the same page, talking the same language. And it's really cool because other teams will have no clue what you're talking about in games. And you can coach without needing timeouts and all of this stuff.
Yeah, I actually did that exercise, put it all together. And not only did I give it to my coaches, but I gave it to our players as well. You know, so we called, for example, we called, we talked about in part one about how we were a no middle team, and the high post area, we called it Manhattan because that's the most, that's the most expensive, it's the most valuable real estate in the world is Manhattan in New York. Yeah. And so, hey, we want to get to Manhattan on offense. We want to prevent our opponents from getting to Manhattan on defense because it's the most valuable spot that you can be at on the floor. So I think that type of thing was or that type of vocabulary is so important that you have that top from top down and bottom up, and then, you know, again, kind of correcting and encouraging those mistakes. You have to. I think one of the things when you're trying to implement a concepts based offense, a motion based offense, whatever phrase you want to use or term to use, I think you have to prepare yourself for players making mistakes and knowing how you're going to address those mistakes. Would you agree with that?
That's it. 100% I would. And I think it makes you better as a coach because you have to give very specific feedback, and you can't. Within the dominant approach, I see a lot of general feedback, like, oh, guys, we're losing the ball. Take care of the ball, or finish possessions. But really, just that stuff means nothing to the players. So we've got to be as specific as possible. So what I mean by that is, let's say we're in this conceptual offense and we are turning the ball over against the switching defense. And maybe what's happening is they're making the pass into the roller when there's a defender tagging every mm-hmm. time and stopping the roll, and they're not seeing who the empty player is and making that skip pass, right? I'm just giving mm-hmm. an example.
Yep.
And we've seen that's a common theme, and that's happened in a few of the turnovers. Well, then we talk about, yes, we've got to take care of the ball, but in this setting. So this means we want you to look and make a better decision based on reading the tags, right? Mm-hmm. So it forces you to coach differently because you have to watch differently. Mm-hmm. And you start focusing very specifically on what the players are doing and what the other team are doing. And now you can give feedback. And what I always say to coaches is one or two things, maximum three, mm-hmm. but just one or two things, but highly specific as you can, build on it, use your language, as opposed to just saying something like play hard, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course there can be a time for that. Yeah. I'm not saying there isn't, but we got to be specific and give tangible things to the players.
Mm-hmm. Want to know more about A Pen and a Napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. You go through, when you're talking about building your conceptual offense, screen away. Alex has got it. He throws it to Marty. Alex goes screen away for Billy, whoever Billy is. But you're going screen away for Billy, and depending on where I have the ball, depending on the angle of your screen, depending on how Billy's being defended, the options are, of course, limitless as to how Billy, Marty, and Alex can read that situation and coming off of it. And so I think that one of the biggest pieces of advice that I've given to coaches who want to do conceptual versus pattern is, this is not going to happen in a day. It's not going to happen in a week. It's probably not going to happen in a season. And I think even with a good patterned offense, it takes a full season, if not a season and a half, to really get that down. So when you're talking about teaching kids concepts, you can't just throw in the towel after a week or 2 weeks and say, well, they're just not getting it. If you're going to commit to it, you got to commit to it, and it's got to be, you got to stay with it. But when that light bulb goes off, it's a magical, magical thing.
It really is. And I think the best results I've seen is we call it like the youth conceptual offense. It's on our website, Transforming It. We've had I'd say about 200 high school coaches in the US who have used it. And we've had 10 state championships using these ideas. And guess what? Most of them are all in the second season. And it's even been complete turnarounds from losing teams to the first year because they're patient with the process and they don't ditch it after five games, like you said. Mm-hmm. They keep going. The difference is when you do these conceptual principles, the players get so much better during mm-hmm. the year compared to the other teams who, because they're just doing the same thing every time on offense, they're not actually making these decisions. They're not having to, you know, have work on different skills. Mm-hmm. So I think it's so important to stay at it. And when it's not going well, focus on the two things which are hurting your team the most, I call it a rate limiter, the two most specific things in your offense, and then use the CLA to work on that in practice. And then the idea is every single game, identify two highly specific rate limiters subject to your team's offense. Mm-hmm. So it could be maybe you're running your screen aways, Marty, and you weren't creating advantages against the switch every time. So that means, you know, in the next practice, all right, we're going to look at how we beat the switch, or we're going to look at our screening angle and our slips. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at rolling underneath. We're going to look at maybe screening our own mm-hmm. against the switch.
Yep.
And then over time, if you do this and you're really specific, A, your practices will be different in response to what happens in the game, but your team is going to get so much better than anyone else in the league.
Mm-hmm. So one of the great things about your book, Alex, and we talked about it a little bit in part one, is not only do you identify the problems, but you put out some solutions, a lot of solutions. And chapter 8, I think, yes, it's a list and a description of, I don't know, you probably got 40, 45 drills in there. Maybe that might be a little bit on the high side, but there's a lot of drills in there that you've put in there. So I'm not gonna give away the cow and or anything like that. We're still gonna make them buy the milk here. So, but if you had to pick, like, what comes to mind here, three of your favorite drills from the drills that you put in the book that you think, you know, just to give coaches an example, and it'll be hard to, you know, do your best to explain it. You know, obviously this is an audio platform here, describe three of your favorite drills that you're talking about, and the drills chapter is absolutely awesome, folks. So, but yeah, what are kind of three of your favorite? We'll limit it to that.
Okay, great. So I think I'm a huge fan of what I call it 3-on-2 dominoes bursts. So that is, you can get your whole team, every player understanding how to use an offensive advantage with that activity. And the best thing is, it's, you know, even if you use whatever your offense you use, the aim of any offense is not to run a pattern, it's to create an advantage. I don't think we can dispute that. So every player needs to know Domino's principles and be able to do it. So essentially what you do is you just put three players on offense, two on defense, and you use this concept in the book I call bursts, where instead of one rep rotate, they stay in offense and defense in the same fixed roles for maybe 45 seconds. So
gotcha.
What that allows you to do is get, I've timed it compared to the domino approach, and you can get up to 7 times more reps, which is incredible for learning. So what the offense are going to do is they could be a shot clock. So maybe there's a 10-second shot clock and they've got to score a layup or a catch and shoot open three. Nothing else, because it's 3-on-2. And they got a shot clock to do it. The defense is live trying to steal the ball. So we might play that round one and then everyone rotates. Then maybe the second round, we say, okay, you're going to be in a different spacing every time. Because often what you see, whenever you do any type of 3-on-3 or 3-on-2, the players always space in the same locations.
Yep.
I can see you showing on the screen, Marty.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying here? Top and wings, right?
Yep.
And then, so what we do is we say, all right, you're in a different spacing every time. So, and maybe you can use the weak side dunker too. So now they get really good because every rep's going to be a different spacing. So the decisions and the pass decisions are going to be different. So that would be Domino's Burst. And there's loads of other constraint ideas. I have, like, I think 8 different constraints just for that activity alone. So it's basically like each one of those could almost be its own small side of game. And,
absolutely.
You know, another one I love is Battleship. So this allows players to learn how to run their actions, aka their triggers, in different parts of the floor. So let's take the screen away because we used that example. Say it's 3-on-3. The first team to win, it's like the board game Battleship. You've got to get 4 different strikes starting dominoes off your screen away in 4 different parts of the floor. So now it's really good because they start being a little bit deceptive as opposed to running the same action in the same place, which the defense very quickly anticipates. Mm-hmm. Now you're keeping the defense on their toes. The offense learns how to mix it up. And I think the last one is maybe 3 lives. And you can do this in any small-sided game from 1-on-1 to 5-on-5. So let's talk about Manhattan and the no middle for your teams.
Okay.
You could apply this concept to 3 lives. So whatever, let's say you've watched the game and you've identified these 2 rate limiters the biggest things hurting your team right now and why they're losing games or not winning like they could.
Yeah.
So you have these two things, and now you create the constraints for them. So let's imagine one was because the other team were beating you off the dribble, getting middle. So what you could say is, in any small-sided game, whether it's even a 5-on-5 scrimmage in practice, the teams have three lives, and they lose a life every time the other team is able to drive middle. And if they get down to zero, they immediately lose. So we could be playing to 15 points, and one team is on 14. They're one away from game, but they lose their last life because they allow middle drive.
Yep.
And the other team is on 5 points, but they would win.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, it's for me, it's the best thing I've found to implement my defense or my offense. And the only interesting thing, Marty, the players start coaching each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm there on the sideline, and that transfers to games. And suddenly they start giving each other feedback, running huddles, being vocal, being great leaders. And I'm not having to say, oh, be a leader, speak up. It just happens because the constraints are so effective and so creative.
And it's created that habit of them coaching themselves.
That's it.
Yeah. Awesome. You and we talked a little bit about this in the first part here, the need for alignment and having everybody on the same page, and most of the coaches that are going to be listening to this are going to be high school coaches, but it's still the same thing. Your young elementary coaches, your middle school coaches, your freshman team, your JV team, your varsity team, your administration, your athletic director, when we're doing this, you know, and you talked a lot in the book about the silos, you know, your athletic training group is right here, and here's your coaching staff, and here's your media people or whatever, you know, when you're talking about the professional level or the collegiate level, that type of thing. But to get everybody in off that, on that same page, to get everybody aligned, if you will, and if you're really going to do this, you know, I think that can be a struggle for a lot of different reasons, and I dealt with that where, you know, I tried to get some top down alignment and it didn't happen the way that I would have liked to have seen it, but I also knew that that was the best way to do it, you know. But, you know, talk about that alignment and that common language, and then also talk about like tracking of the data and the teaching of the shot selection. I guess we kind of went through that a little bit, but just let's go through alignment a little bit, and just, you know, because the more you teach, let's say conceptual offense, you start doing that at fourth grade, your fourth grade team's going to struggle maybe a little bit with that. And it's all relative, right? I mean, fourth graders, if you could just get them, like in my program, I say, if you could just get them that Marty has the ball and he throws it to Alex and he immediately cuts, he knows that as soon as I get rid of the ball, I've got to cut. That's a great starting point. And then we'll build this building block and then this building block. And that's what we're talking about with alignment there, right?
So I think the irony with alignment is it's actually the higher the level of basketball, the more fragmentation often occurs. And it's just because the more resources there are, the more people involved, you know, the greater the siloed effect. So I think the most important thing and the way to kind of get out of these silos is to actually have a very clear vision in place for every staff member in a program. So that would be volunteer coaches, team manager, if you're lucky to have a strength coach, or someone who works with a team in the weight room, them, a physio, and just explaining to them kind of the vision for the team and how they actually want to play. Like, all this, the principles of play. So this is, you know, this is the terminology for what we want to look to do on offense and on defense. Now, with the basic principles of play developed, this might impact how they go about their roles. And then maybe you can then talk about the CLA in terms of, okay, this is the theory that we are using to understand basketball performance and how we're coaching. So it's worth checking out, you know, maybe just take a look at it and see if you could just experiment. You know, you don't necessarily have to change everything you're doing, but see how maybe you could apply the CLA in your specific field. And that starts a conversation. And I think the more you can meet and identify use your staff to identify these rate limiters and talk about it, because you know, sometimes a rate limiter could be, the most important rate limiter could be related to strength and conditioning or a nutritionist as opposed to basketball. Mm-hmm. You never know. So I think just having these conversations frequently is very key. And having the, you know, it all comes down to the unique language, which we spoke about earlier on this episode. I think the more you have a language, the easier it is to have some of these conversations in your program.
How do you, as a high school coach, and I know you're the vast majority of your experience is overseas, and your model in Europe is different than ours in America.
Above youth level.
Yeah. But what do you do? What advice do you have for the high school coach that, okay, I've got this talented group of, let's say, sixth graders, and I want them to start doing this at sixth grade, but I've got the sixth grade dad that says, well, hey, I want to win this sixth grade trophy right now. Well, maybe doing this, yeah, you're not going to win as much in sixth grade, but I guarantee you by the time they're freshmen, boy, we're really going to be rolling there. How do you handle those situations?
That's it. So I think the first one is try and send them this podcast, maybe. and just, you know, like, see, but I understand the constraints, right? And there's volunteer parent coaches, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the first thing is just a conversation in terms of, you know, yes, it's not about winning at this age group, because we want, the most important thing is actually their development and then becoming more skillful. And ironically, that means they might not win games. Now, in a best case scenario, they win games because they're more skilled, but you might lose games because you're not running these heavily scripted patterns that other young kids can't defend.
Yeah.
But it's better to win games because you're more skilled than because you're running an X and O or a set play. Mm-hmm. And the idea, you know, is, we want to develop at this age, and to develop, that requires conceptual offense. You can't develop players within a highly controlled system because they're just not going to get the game reps they need to become better decision makers. So yes, you might win a sixth grade trophy, but no one's going to remember that trophy in 2 years, let alone 5 years, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So it's far more important to the development for the long-term game of play. And I think the easiest way for coaches listening, if they have a volunteer coach, is create your principles of play, because this podcast is, you know, we're talking about on a napkin, do it on a napkin, mm-hmm. right? Have it just literally a small piece of paper where you just have your base principles of play, which a sixth grade team could do. Dominoes, gold, bronze, silver medals, one-on-one. Mm-hmm. Really simple, but at least now you have a clear idea of what you're going to do on offense and maybe what you're going to do on defense, right? We're going to switch everything. We're going to be man-to-man. We're going to be in the gaps, or we're going to be in denial, whatever it is. Now, I'd say give them 10 small-sided games that they could use in their practice. And this is where the chapter in the book comes in handy. Yep. You could literally just use those.
Yep.
And say, all right, you use these in your practices, cycle between them, and if you feel comfortable, see if you can identify your own constraints based on what you're seeing in your principles of play. But it might take you a few weeks or a few months to get to that point where you're comfortable. So just get used to coaching with the small sided games, get comfortable explaining it to the players, running the practice, managing them. And when you feel confident, now see if you can change the games in response to where they're at. And I think if they can do that, and you're like a JV or varsity coach, you would have a ridiculous competitive advantage compared to any other team in a conference or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Let's talk a little player development plan, PDP. And as the kids get older, you know, you start to see, okay, Jimmy's 6'7", and again, the game's different from my seasoned and experienced state. If a kid was 6'7" back in, I don't want to date myself too much, but Margaret Thatcher was still the prime minister in England. But that kid was going to be 4 feet away from the basket. They were going to be posting up the whole time, that type of thing, in a high school level. Whereas today, now we've got 6'7", 6'8", we got 7-footers shooting it from 25 feet away and that type of thing. But, you know, so that's a little bit more fluid today with your player development plan. But talk about that, because I think that's really, really important for coaches as well. A lot of times we think player development is one size fits all. And to a degree, you kind of have to do that. But at the same time, there's certain things that you can do to help. You know, we really need Alex to really emphasize these two or three things in improvement season. And Marty needs to do these two or three things. So kind of go in the book, you talk about a player development plan. Kind of go into that, Alex.
Absolutely. So what I'd recommend coaches do is to start really simply, just create a spreadsheet or a table of all your players and their names on the left, and have three rate limiters for each player that you're going to identify. And these would just be highly specific things in priority order from most important as the first rate limiter, second, third, are things to solve that would make them a more effective, skilled player and help the team more. And what I'd then do is just, you can do it by yourself, or if you have a coaching staff, do it with them, and just identify these three rate limiters for every player on your roster and have them as specific as possible. So this really requires some deep thinking, because it can't just be improve shooting, make ball handling better. No, it's got to be very specific. So it could be handling pressure, bringing the ball up in the backcourt against a full court defense where they're pressuring you man to man. So now that gives you an idea as to what the problem is. And, you know, we spoke on part one about the dribbling through cones, and this is why I wouldn't recommend it, because that's not how they're dribbling in the game. And we got to find a way to recreate that pressure. So it might be a full court one-on-one where they're in a small space, like in between the lane lines. So now they get to get used to handling that pressure. Maybe we even make it a one-on-two, and it's really challenging, right?
Yep.
So that would be an example of a rate limiter. Another one could be maybe their finishing at the basket is not effective when a help defender's really walling up. So we want them to explore maybe some finishes off 2 feet or a Nash dribble dribbling under the basket. So that would be a good example of another rate limiter. And maybe the third rate limiter could be their on-ball defense is not effective off a closeout. So maybe they're closing out, and off a closeout, they often get beat. So you see, Mark, how specific it is.
Yep.
And it should be different for every player, because if these rate limiters are kind of the same for every player, you know, sometimes, all right, that might happen, and you're definitely going to have similar rate limiters for sure, but not for every player, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the idea is that doing it well, you're going to really diagnose these things, maybe even involve the players in the process. And now the best thing is you've got these rate limiters. Well, that impacts your CLA activities and how you plan practice. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to just going into the practice kind of doing the exact same thing for everyone, you can have the same activities for sure, but maybe you just individualize the constraints. So one player has a different constraint compared to another one. And now you're really customizing that learning environment to the fullest.
Yeah. So you're talking like there, let's say 3-on-3 small sided game. Jimmy's just a hellacious catch and shoot kid. Okay. Jimmy, though, it's off season. You're off the bounce game has to get better. So your constraint here, You can't score just off a catch and shoot. You've got to put the football on the floor to do that to score. You just can't catch and shoot. That's the type of stuff that you're talking about there, right?
Sure is. And I love it, because there are two ways, and I often mix between two ways. It's great. It's funny, because I had a player just like that. And you could do exactly like you just said, where you constrain every score. And you could say off the dribble or inside the paint, whatever. And another thing I actually tried doing, Marty, was flipping it with the defense, where if he did score a catch and shoot, it was double.
Yep.
And that was really interesting, because then the defense were in more situated, like flyby closeouts, running them off the line. And that was exactly what we needed, because it wasn't what he was doing well in the game.
Love
it. So it's fun, because you can really start experimenting both sides.
Awesome. You talk about optimal challenge point. Which I loved.
Yes,
talk about that a little bit.
So I love optimal challenge because I think it's actually the it's great you're asked that, Marty, because it's the easiest way to make sense of everything we discussed in part one and two. And it's really, is your activity at the right level of challenge to have a positive impact on learning? So let's take the MyCan drill because we started with that in part one. Well, the optimal challenge on the MyCan would be very low because it's so easy, right? It's just players score every time. So what we know is that the learning value from that is not really that beneficial. Whereas maybe there's an activity which is just really, really hard, and it could just be like playing one-on-one with beginners, and they just can't create an advantage against a defender, right? So now we've got to use the CLA to change it. So maybe we give them an advantage. The defender starts behind them instead of in front of them. Maybe we say the defender's also dribbling a basketball. Maybe they only can play with one hand, right? So there's lots of creative ways we can change the constraints so that the challenge point is more optimal, where it's pleasantly frustrating, it's not too easy, and it's not too difficult. And that's exactly what we want to develop the players. And obviously, what we see in the NBA, traditionally NCAA, is the optimal challenge. Well, it's never optimal. It's just far too low. It's far too easy. So the players aren't really improving. And the only way they're improving is just through luck in the game.
One of the things I really liked as well is you talked about kind of designating, if you will, and for some coaches, like if you're in Omaha, Nebraska, if you're in London, England, you have the opportunity to find more coaches who are probably more qualified than you can in a, let's say, a smaller rural community, and you're just looking for a good person to help you out. But if possible, and the if I were ever to get back into it, this is something that I would really, really consider doing, a skills acquisition coach, or basically just a coach that focuses on skill, you know, and skill development. Or you, I'm sorry, you call it a skills acquisition specialist. I want to make sure I get the verbiage right from the book.
No,
So,
I was
yeah.
it. No,
But
I was it.
again, if I were to get back into it, if I were to do it over again, this is something that I would have emphasized more. Just, hey, Alex, your
I
number
love
one
that.
job is skill development. I mean, you know, and you talk about that. Go ahead and kind of talk about that and what you brought about with that in the book.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I hope you do get back into coaching because I'd love to see the players that would come out of Omaha, Marty. Because I can tell you now, there's not a single high school where this happens yet. And guess what? In the NBA, there's one skill acquisition specialist in the NBA, right? So it's pretty nuts. And this is 2024 at the time of recording. So I think it's the next Moneyball. So I'm sure every team is going to have a skill acquisition person within the next decade. But I think it's a great idea, especially in high school, because you want to tap into keen people, keen volunteers, keen coaches who have an interest in learning and feel like they can positively impact the team. And so giving them all specific roles makes them feel valued as part of the process. And like you said, if you say to one person, all right, your focus is on skill acquisition and basically how can we constantly create really engaging, effective learning environments? And their job is just to come to the head coach with ideas. So maybe they listen to one podcast a week and they come with ideas and they give like two ideas to the coach every week. Maybe they send bullet note feedback from a practice and say, hey, next time, let's have a think about using this constraint here. You know, imagine over time the impact that would have on coaching. And it sounds so simple, Marty, but this isn't happening right now in the NCAA or the NBA even. It's insane because it's not rocket science, right? That being more specific, being more intentional will make you better. So I love that you said that. And I would make me delighted to hear of a high schooler does that, hopefully sometime next season.
One of the things that I tried to do is I would ask like a retired coach, hey, come to our practice,
Great idea.
come to our practice, watch us, you know, here's a practice plan, but you don't know anybody, just watch my players, watch how we're coaching them, what can we do, what are we doing well, what do we need to do better, and you got to be willing to open yourself up to constructive criticism
Be
and all those
vulnerable.
things, but we ask our players to be coachable. We've got to be coachable as well as coaches, right?
Yeah, we have to. And I think sometimes when people come across kind of transforming for the first time, I think they get an inaccurate impression of like who I am and who my team are and what we're doing, because we are the most vulnerable, open-minded people ever. And there's one criteria to work for transforming, and that is you have to be a lifelong learner. You have to be open. You have to be vulnerable. And I'm openly asking my staff to challenge me the whole time, because I don't think you could live all these ideas, Marty, that we've spoken about on both podcasts and not be open-minded to new ideas, change, etc. So that vulnerability, to me, the best coaches are the most vulnerable ones, the ones who are most curious about learning and constantly trying to get better. And that's why I think, you know, a great example to me is Joe Mazzulla for the Celtics. I think he's a great example of a coach who has that growth mindset and is not afraid to go away from the status quo to learn new things.
Coaches, it is official. October 12th and 13th, Saturday and Sunday, October 12th and 13th, 2024, will be our first annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Retreat. It is going to be over 24 hours of just basketball coaching and getting yourself primed and ready for the upcoming season. We're going to do a lot of different things. Coach Flannery and the staff at Creighton University have been gracious enough to allow us to come in and watch them practice that day. We're going to have roundtable sessions with coaches that you're attending the clinic with, which is one of the best aspects of any A Pen and a Napkin event. We're going to have a full timeout situation score group discussion with the coaches that are attending, as well as coaches social, and then, of course, guest speakers. We got some great coaches lined up right now. We're probably going to be adding a couple of more here. It is going to be a great, great weekend here in Omaha. We'll be staying at the Holiday Inn Express at 87th and West Dodge Road here in Omaha, and it is really, really affordable. $200 for the weekend, and that includes food, that includes your lodging at the hotel, drinks, everything that goes into it. It is going to be included in that $200 for well over 24 hours worth of activities. If you're a commuter, if you're living in the Omaha area and you want to join in, but you don't want to stay at the hotel, it's $125. Think of that. That's literally what, $5-6 an hour for an entire weekend of becoming a better coach. So coaches, I encourage you to sign up as soon as you can for the first annual A Pen and a Napkin Fall Coaches Retreat. Yeah, just, be careful with there's some Boston fans that get frustrated with Joe Mazz at times too. So, but again, that's the basketball Twitter. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that's part of the process. And we may look at, and again, only time will tell. 10 years from now, we might be like, hey, Joe Mazz kind of saw in the future a little bit, you know, and that's part of it. If you had two or three, and while we're talking about that, you know, if you wanted to study this more, just in a live section, or just, you know, like, you know, most people get on YouTube to look up Bobby Knight, you know, Mike Krzyzewski, Pat Summitt, whatever it may be. But right now, who are some of the coaches that you see that are really doing the transforming basketball thing at a really high level that people can look to study and emulate and kind of get more live stuff other than the resources that you've provided through the book and through the website and that type of stuff?
Yeah, great question. So I would say a few people who strike me coming from the book would be coaches Joe Boylan at the Minnesota Timberwolves. He's an assistant coach, director of player development, but he's got some great activities. He posts actually quite frequently on social media, just with his thoughts about this area. I think the team at Mizzou, so I actually did some work with them consulting last year. So Dennis Gates, Matt Kleinen. Dennis has shared a lot of the CLA activities that were in the practices actually on his personal Twitter X account. So they're worth checking out. I think at the highest level, I think Joe Mazzulla in the NBA is, you hear some things about the practice environment of the Celtics, and it completely aligns with what we believe in at transforming. I also think Will Weaver, who's an assistant coach in the NBA, but his knowledge of the CLA is like probably, I'd say, some of the most complete in professional basketball. And I think too, I'd say this, I think the college landscape and the NBA landscape is changing a lot. And I know, like, I can say it's really cool. We've actually got a few head coaches in the NBA reading the book and in the NCAA. So I think over the next few months and years, we're going to see way more, a lot more coaches kind of connect with this. And I think we're going to see more CLA practice activities emerging. Mm-hmm. And then it's good because coaches will be able to see it, recognize it, and be like, huh, now, you know, so-and-so at X university is doing it. And I think that will be big for this movement to really, you know, it will be good for the cause when that starts happening.
Yeah. And then you get all the credit, right?
I don't know. I'll give the credit to the researchers I stole this from.
Let's talk about shot selection, and you do a great job of breaking down the best shots in the game. And again, like sometimes, again, with high school coaches, let's say, I really only have two or three kids that can really shoot it outside of 4 feet or whatever. But when you get to those teams, or as you develop your program and you get that alignment with your youth programs and things like that, these are also things you can talk about. So go through, you called it gold, silver, bronze, shot selection, that type of thing. We kind of, when I was coaching, we did the Don Meyer 4-3-2-1-0 type of thing, right. But we address those numbers. But you kind of took it another level to specific spots on the floor and where to identify kind of the hot spots, if you will. So go into that a little bit, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd say it's funny because you don't have the charge circle, I don't believe, in high school in the U.S.
No, nope, we don't.
If you did, imagine it would, you know, I basically say section that final third of the paint and designate that as the gold medal spot, which we're trying to get to as much of the time. And I think it's a huge difference between shooting a floater and getting that gold medal. It's huge in terms of the numbers and the efficiency of it. And I think it's better for players when they know that they can't settle for that floater, but they got to get the gold medal. It makes their finishing so much better because they have to adapt the whole time in every practice activity. Now, of course, later, by all means, add the floater. It could be a useful tool for some players. But I think by constraining it and taking it away in doses, it affords them other things and it makes them a better finisher, which, let's be honest, I think if more players, they need to be good at the basics. And the basics for me would be finishing at the rim, catch and shoot threes, right? So it's getting them better at that. Silver medals would be catch and shoot threes. Specifically, you know, the best ones as part of that would be in the corner threes, the shortest three, higher, you know, the higher the percentage, taking them from there. But then, you know, above the break, three catch and shoot would also count as a silver, and a bronze would be off the dribble three. Now, you could also, some coaches have tweaked that to say off the dribble three or a paint shot inside the paint, but not a gold medal. No problem with that. Completely cool. And then kind of the idea is, you know, we're obviously going to be early in the shot clock. And obviously it depends on what state you're in the U.S. the center is from, if you have one or not.
Yeah.
In Europe, it's all 24 seconds from under 12s. So, you know, even under 12s have that 24-second clock. So we would be going for gold, silver medals in really the first two-thirds of the shot clock. And say it gets to the last 8 seconds, well, then we'll just take the best shot we can get.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a bronze medal, could be a paid two, whatever. You know, we would rather have that than come up without a medal on that possession and have a turnover, right? Now, it is worth saying, if there's a player who can shoot the mid-range at a efficiency of a silver medal or gold medal, by all means, they can let that thing fly at 18 seconds, no problem. But we've got to know that with the numbers that the players are efficient at that, so you don't have a player who's shooting 35% from the mid-range coming down, jacking a contested midi up at 16 on the clock, which we see a lot, including the NBA, but it's difficult, you know, because obviously you got roles and you have, you know, naturally as coaches, we have egos. I have an ego, players have egos. So, you know, that's a difficult, delicate conversation when it comes into shot selection. But there are some things I've done in the past to kind of frame it in a positive way, where it's not just saying to a player, you can only shoot this shot. That's not going to be very effective, especially in the NBA, but it's more, all right, how can we put you in a position to perform better, get better numbers, do better for the team and average more points a game? Well, it starts by taking better shots.
Yeah. And that's the number one thing. Like, I was always very hesitant to tell a kid, don't shoot. you know, yeah, now take a good shot for us, take a good shot for you, but you've got to, you know, you've got to allow those kids to, again, and sometimes you have to encourage mistakes, and then 100%. By proxy on that, you could say, hey, Billy, the last, you know, we've played 8 games, you've taken 16 shots from this range, and you're 1 for 16. Now, I'm not saying that they're not bad shots. 14 of those 16 shots we graded out as good looks, but they're not falling for you right now. Yeah. So maybe we, but here you've taken 5 shots from this kind of shot range. You've made 4 of them. Yeah. Try to get to these spots. It'll be good for you, and it'll be good for us. You know, and I think that's kind of the way you handle those kind of conversations, don't you, Alex?
100%. That's exactly it.
Yep. All right. Hey, let's. You got one book down. Here it is. One book down. When's the next one coming? That's the next question. We had Star Wars. Now we had to wait for The Empire Strikes Back. You know. So what do we got coming on here?
I'm aiming, Marty, for a similar release time, so around April 2025. I've actually got most of the book complete, which is great, but I am a perfectionist at heart, and it actually takes me far longer rewriting, going through and tweaking things when it's already done versus writing new chapters.
Sure.
But I want to get it as good, if not better, than part one. Mm-hmm. And I'm really determined to do that. So I'm going to take my time to do it well. Mm-hmm. And the goal will be releasing it in April. And then until then, I've just got a bunch of resources we'll be sharing at Transforming, you know, a bunch of free ones on our website. We got some paid ones like our membership site coming out, mm-hmm. courses. But we really just want to help every coach at every level of basketball, from NBA to grassroots, become a more effective coach and fulfill their potential and ultimately help the players mm-hmm. get better.
Yeah. And what are going to be some of the themes in the sequel here?
So a whole chapter on shooting. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my more enjoyable ones because mm-hmm. it gets very interesting when you look at how these ideas apply to shooting. Whole chapter on working with beginners. And that was also one of my favorite ones. Feedback and actually what it looks like to use feedback within this approach. Mm-hmm. Department of Methodology, and that was one specific to college and MBA, but still lots of practical applications for high school. So, yeah, there's some really cool chapters in there that I'm excited to get out.
Awesome. Again, we talked about it in part one. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I'm a little hurt. But if you haven't listened to part one and you haven't got there yet, but you want to order this book right now, how do they get it, Alex?
So head to Amazon.com and just search for Transforming Basketball Book, and you'll see it come up first in the rankings. And if you do get it and you do enjoy it, I would sincerely appreciate a review and your honest feedback.
Mm-hmm. And if folks want to know more, you talked about the website, you know, socials, that type of stuff. How do they know more about it there?
Absolutely. So head to TransformingBeeBall.com. That's our website. And just follow Transforming Beeball on social media. And you'll see all the latest from what we're doing.
Awesome. Alex Sarama, it has been a privilege and a pleasure. I hope you have enjoyed being on A Pen and a Napkin here over in the States.
The pleasure was all mine, Marty. I really enjoyed this one. So big thanks for taking the time to do this. And thanks for having me on the podcast.
Well, hey, if you're ever in Omaha, Nebraska, I'll take you out for a good steak here, and
I would love that.
And we'll get out some napkins and we'll start drawing some stuff up. How's that sound?
There we go.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, hold on to the Zoom here a second. I'm going to wrap up here, Alex. Again, terrific book, Alex Sarama, Transforming Basketball. Folks, I hope you understand. I wouldn't dedicate 2 podcasts and together. It hasn't felt like almost 2 hours, but we've been doing this for almost 2 hours this afternoon. It would have been less than that if I'd have been able to figure out the Zoom stuff earlier. But Alex has just been a great deal. So I highly encourage the book. you know, the first couple of chapters, I will admit, it takes a little bit to get through kind of the methodology and that type of stuff. Yeah. But once you understand that and how it pieces together, you're really going to enjoy it. And I hope you embrace a lot of the teachings that Alex threw out there. So check his stuff out. Again, founding sponsor, COSAC Chiropractic. Want to thank them for being our founding sponsor. Follow us on Twitter at @APenAndANapkin. Download, rate, review this one. Give us 5 stars. Like Alex was saying, give us a good review. Say good things about us. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. For Alex Sarama and Transforming Basketball Coaches, I hope, and everybody that's listening, I hope you've enjoyed this. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.